Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. I'm delighted to see you here. I'm delighted to be here. Dug out from Snowmageddon in a week, a very surreal week. Seemed like a time warp. At any rate, we're starting to get back to some degree of normalcy. Not full normalcy, though, as it seems as though the events are... the gods are trying to conspire against us with the derailment of the Red Line and the closing down of K Street. Therefore, the caterers who are bringing lunch for today have not been able to make it, and so I'm afraid there is no free lunch. Nevertheless, I think we have a much more important reason to be here, and there will be a lot of food for thought provided by our distinguished guests. Mr. Vigen Sargsyan, the Deputy Chief of Staff to the President of the Republic of Armenia. He is in the States for a couple of days, was up in New York yesterday and down here in D.C. today, and would hopefully be able to have some meetings with the administration now that the U.S. government is back open after being closed for 4 days. It's pretty hard to believe the U.S. government being closed for 4 days. It would seem to be some kind of national security risk. To some extent, or maybe it's a benefit that it's closed. I don't know. At any rate, Mr. Sargsyan has been working in the president's office in Yerevan since 2003, and in January of 2009, he was promoted to the deputy chief of staff. He has undergraduate and master's degrees from Yerevan University, and he also did a master's at the Fletcher School in Boston. About 10 years ago, and he has been extremely a critical figure in the development of Armenia's foreign policy and national security strategy over the years, and we look, we're delighted to have you here today, and we look forward to what you have to say about the prospects of Armenian-Turkish normalization, and we look forward to this discussion. And let me also take this opportunity to thank and to welcome Ambassador Markaryan and for the opportunity to host this event today. The meeting is on the record, so the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and thank you for making it here despite all the conspiracies, and thank you for hosting this event. I understand the responsibility I now get when the caterers are not here. I have to be even more challenging in the comments so that we can have a more rewarding discussion in the absence of a free lunch. And I would like to start off with a few comments and then maybe open it up for question and answer, which might be more interesting in terms of the issues of concern. I assume that most of those present are aware of the details, and I do not need to repeat the whole timeline of this process. In a very nutshell, I just want to recall that it was after the presidential elections in Armenia, within a few months after, actually within 2 months after President Sarkisian assumed his office, that he has extended invitation to his Turkish colleague, the President of the Turkish Republic, Abdullah Gül, to visit Armenia and jointly watch the football game in a World Cup qualifier between two national teams. Of course, it was a good opportunity to start a dialogue on issues which have been of concern for such a long period of time and ever since independence, basically. And the invitation that was extended in June was answered after the war in Georgia erupted in August, and when a few days were remaining to the football game in early September, we received a response that the Turkish side has decided to accept that invitation, and we were privileged to host President Gül in Armenia. I don't know what was on the margins of what, watching of a football game on the margins of negotiations that took place or vice versa, but the result was that the president had expressed a very strong commitment not to leave the problems for the future generations, which I think was a very good formulation of that, and they have requested their ministers of foreign affairs to work towards a comprehensive agreement that would allow for a start-up in relations which actually did not exist before that at the interstate level. This launched a long process of negotiations at the level of ministers of foreign affairs that culminated in a joint statement in April 2009 with regards to the agreement of the sides to approve a roadmap for improvement of relations. And later on, in August, on August 31st, parties decided to disclose the content of the agreements, that the protocols that have been agreed, so launched a six-week internal political discussions to allow for public opinion and public comments on this. Protocols were signed in Zurich on October 10 in presence of ministers of foreign affairs of Russia, France, Secretary of State of the United States, Swiss Minister of Foreign Affairs, and you know that Swiss have been very instrumental in helping to arrange the discussions and provide the technical ground and the floor, the forum for those negotiations, and also the European Union represented by Javier Solana. After that, we moved to the next stage and the reciprocal visit of President of Armenia to Turkey on a football game in Bursa, where we were very warmly received by our Turkish colleagues, were treated to an outstanding dinner, which Abdullah Gül mentioned was cooked partially by his wife, which is a very important symbolic message that was given at that event, showing the warmth of hospitality and sincerity of relations, we assume. We moved to the next stage of ratification after that. The process is still there with all procedural issues solved on both sides and with road for voting in Parliament open now. As you know, throughout the process, there have been two major tests applied to the success or failure of this process, applied not only by parties, by Armenia and Turkey, but also by all those international actors involved. The first part of the test was that it has to happen in a logical time frame, and the second part of the test that it has to happen without any preconditions attached. And both of these have been very well thought through tests because of particular reasons, and I want to talk about them a little bit now. The logical time frame was essential because we had a strong feeling, I guess on both sides, and I think we have felt the same approach in the Turkish negotiators at the time when the protocols were under discussion, that the time does not really favor this process, that more time is taken by this process, more difficulties we might see coming up, considering all the external inputs and possible affections and internal processes in two countries. We thought that existence of this process can be damaging in a number of ways. And the most important in the view of Armenian side is a possible dangerous damage the process itself can have on the Armenian Azerbaijani talks over Nagorno-Karabakh. Let me explain you why. Because Karabakh settlement, whatever it is and whenever it is reached, is a very complex one which is rooted in painful concessions for both parties, as we understand that. We thought that if this process is open-ended and allows to affect the situation in the region, it would create a condition where for President of Azerbaijan, it would decrease the level of motivation to give any concession and any progress on Nagorno-Karabakh because he would be feeling that he is giving up two things at the same time, what he is concessing immediately and a face saver for Turkey to normalize relations with Armenia, and therefore his motivation to do it would decrease. For Armenian side, it would be difficult because whatever concessions we do would be perceived domestically as being done under the pressure of Turkey. Therefore, this process, as it is now, without finalization, is, in our view, harmful for the settlement of Nagorno-Karabakh conflict as the process develops now. The second part of the test was the test of no preconditions. Why? Because the very reason of the existing difficulties between Armenia and Turkey were in two major issues of concern for these two countries. In Turkey, there was a serious concern with regards to the situation on Nagorno-Karabakh when forces of self-defense of Nagorno-Karabakh were able to stop the aggression by Azerbaijani army and basically secure the survival of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh by taking under control certain territories around Nagorno-Karabakh. And after that, Turkey decided to close the border, basically, and decided to implement what is effectively a blockade of the country on the Turkish border. For Armenia, it was an issue of the recognition of the Armenian genocide. And that issue is, as you understand, extremely painful, both for Armenians in Armenia and Armenians in diaspora. And it was seriously damaging the level of trust, mutual trust, and mutual confidence in the region. When we were speaking about relations without preconditions, it was to meant that the two sides have decided to put aside and put on hold those major disagreements which exist between them and give a start to relations which would then allow to address many and all problems that might be of mutual concern and interest. I want to be very clear here. What is in the protocols is not an end of our dialogue with Turkey. It's purely, and in the best scenario, only the beginning of those relations that were effectively blocked till now. What do these protocols do? They, A, allow for establishment of diplomatic relations between two countries, which doesn't mean that the problems between countries are solved. Many countries in the world do have diplomatic relations, having reasonable disagreements on all major issues of their bilateral cooperation and bilateral relations in general. And second, it would allow for the deblockading of the Armenian border, which is only so logical and only so normal between two countries, one of which has European membership aspirations and the other is a member of the Eastern Partnership Initiative by the European Union. What is in it for Armenia and what is in it for Turkey? It's a very important question which needs to be answered to understand the level of motivation and possible challenges to the process. For Armenia, this opening means an exemplary approach to the solving of existing problems in the region. We always insisted and we always believed that the best way to solve problems is through regional cooperation. We always believed in open borders, in communications, in infrastructures, and we think that these allow for peoples to understand each other better. We think that it creates a lot of common ground, a lot of common interest, and that allows to address even the most difficult issues between neighboring countries. We have seen a lot of it in Europe. We think it's a good example. We think it's an applicable example, and we think we are mature enough to live up to that standard. For Armenia, in short run, it means serious economic challenges to our domestic producers, considering the differences in the economy of Turkey and Armenia. But in long run, we think it's a major economic opportunity for the whole region that would can allow to explore the comparative advantages of each of the country, or in case of Turkey, regions adjust them to the border with Armenia, which do have serious economic issues themselves. And it would allow for a lot of people-to-people contacts and a lot of contacts at the civil society level, which in themselves can be very instrumental in solving the grief and disagreements and emotions that exist between the two peoples. What is in it for Turkey, in our view? I think that, first of all, it's the best way for Turkey to return itself to the political map of South Caucasus. Despite outstanding role Turkey is playing in Euro-Atlantic security arrangements, despite its outstanding relations with Georgia and almost family ties with Azerbaijan, it's effectively out of the regional processes in South Caucasus because it has self-isolated itself by taking sides in one of the key conflicts existing in this region. And in our view, basically, this would allow Turkey to regain its role in the South Caucasus as a regional player that has a say. Now, when we say that there is no linkage between this rapprochement and our Nagorno-Karabakh settlement, of course, we are not naive. We do understand that if the border is open and the relations are established, there will be many leverages for Turkey to get involved in these discussions, not only on Nagorno-Karabakh, but on all other regional issues that exist in South Caucasus. And we consider it to be natural. But we don't think one shall be conditioned by the other. We think that one shall be supportive of the other. One shall be setting an example for the other. And this is visionary leadership that is expected in the 21st century, as opposed to realpolitik approach of use of force and blockades and embargoes and so on. Now we are at the stage where basically it's time to make political decision. The process has gone too far. The protocols are signed. They are publicized. A lot of political image and political capital is vested into that by both parties. And now there is nothing that is precluding voting on the protocols into parliaments. You have heard Armenian side speaking recently about the possibility of approaching a no-return point. Of course, we do not set a particular deadline for this for two reasons, or rather for three reasons probably. First of all, deadlines are not good in diplomacy in general because they decrease the level of flexibility. Second, because we don't think that it's a right start for relations between countries which haven't had been talking to each other for decades to start talking with each other with a language of dates and particular time frames. And third, because we think that it can create public perceptions that would make difficult for any of the parties to move on a particular timetable. But we have been very vocal, both with our Turkish colleagues and with all those involved in the process, to identify what is the possible no-return point in our view. I want to be very clear with you. If anything was happening in this process till now, it was happening exactly because there have been time flags throughout this process. We have basically received a confirmation of visit by President Gül because the football game was scheduled for a particular date, and after that date there would be no possibility of accepting that invitation. We have had signed a joint statement on April 22 because of the known reasons and because it was a date when it was needed, and after that it would be senseless probably. We have made a joint statement and published protocols on August 31st because we had agreed for a six-week period of domestic consultations, and that was exactly 6 weeks before the Bursa football games that it was published. We have signed protocols on October 10 to allow President of Armenia to accept the invitation and pay a return visit to Turkey for a return game on October 14. We have done that visit because the football game was happening on October 14. In other words, I am showing you that everything that has happened till now has happened exactly because there was a particular understanding of the time constraints in this process. Now it's a situation where we believe there is another flag post out there. What is that flag post? First of all, it's, of course, April 24th anniversary of commemoration of the genocide, which is the 95th anniversary, and it's extremely emotional, especially upon the background of this process, which, as you understand, has many opponents everywhere in Turkey and in Armenia and in the Armenian diaspora, and that's only natural. Second, we take into consideration the upcoming new political season in the Turkish politics with parliamentary elections scheduled for 2011. And if there is no even rescheduling of that to bring them closer, it still allows only 1 year before them. The experience shows that in such period of time, basically moving forward on difficult decisions is only more difficult, never more easy. Third, we take into consideration very serious reforms that are being offered now by Prime Minister Erdogan internally for Turkish political system, and we think that upon the background of such reforms, adding to this any more elements like rapprochement with Armenia would not probably be an easy task. We therefore see nothing that will be happening, let's say, between March and May that would be increasing the level of motivation of Turkish side to vote in favor of this in parliament later rather than sooner. We have heard, and we fully understand the concern of the Turkish side when they say that they want to have a non-partisan support for this in their parliament, and they want to work with the opposition. Ever since the protocols have been signed, Minister Davutoglu has been very active in talking to different factions in the parliament, trying to convince them to get on board. We understand that. It's logical, and in terms of political capital, it's understandable. But it should be appreciated at the same time. It should be taken into consideration at the same time that Armenia, with the commitments it has taken on itself in this process, has gone as far as witnessing the drop from its own coalition, governing coalition, in face of the Dashnaktsum party, which basically withdrew from the coalition because of these protocols. In other words, we have been able to sustain that type of risk domestically in our political domain, and we do expect that the Turkish side has to take its own risk, political risk, of putting this on vote and assuring that the majority that the ruling party in Turkey has in parliament allows for voting in favor of these protocols. There is much discussion about what can be done now. By external actors, by international players, to allow for such a progress as soon as possible. I have to be honest with you. I mean, this process would not be possible if not all the support we have been receiving throughout this process, both from international actors and from all those players involved. We highly appreciate the role played personally by President Obama, who has launched this in April when he was in Istanbul talking to Prime Minister Erdogan and the President Gül. We very much appreciate the direct and close involvement by Secretary Clinton, by Undersecretary Steinberg, by Phil Gordon, and all the others who are key players on this in this administration. We have been very thankful to Russians for the roles they have played through their Ministry of Foreign Affairs and through their Prime Minister's office and President, when publicly and privately they have been very supportive of this throughout the process. We cannot be appreciative enough of all the efforts put in it by Swiss government and Swiss Minister of Foreign Affairs personally. But to tell you the truth, we think that now it's time for parties to make up their minds. We think that there is no international pressure that would be effective at this stage in terms of moving this forward. Because voting for it in Parliament is not the end of the story, just the beginning of the story. Then we get to next more difficult stage of implementation. We get to next more difficult stage of making this sustainable, making this effective. And that's where it can happen only if there is a will of parties to do this. Armenian side has identified very clearly that it's ready to proceed. The day before yesterday, I was with the president of Armenia at Chatham House, where he spoke against the Chatham House rules on record, and it's all out there publicly placed on the websites. He has stated that he is ready to put in his own political capital and his authority as the head of ruling political party in Armenia to assure that the voting in parliament will be in favor of ratification if the Turkish parliament proceeds to ratify as agreed with no preconditions and in a timely manner. He has also stated that he will be sending the protocols to the parliament, which is the last stage in ratification process, and which is a very positivistic signal to identify our readiness. Of course, you understand that when you send it to parliament from the president's office, it creates new difficulties internally, because as the chairman of the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs in the National Assembly is representative of Dashnaktsum party, which, as you know, is strongly against the ratification of the protocols. And there is no doubt that this will raise a lot of discussion internally in the political elite of Armenia as to the necessity and effectiveness of the times chosen and so on and so forth. Now the question is, with all that being done, will the Turkish side signal its readiness to progress? We have sent another signal as well as far as yesterday. The government has sent to the parliament amendments to the law of the Republic of Armenia on law of treaties. Our law of treaties lacked provision allowing the government to withdraw its signature from a treaty that is signed but not ratified for some reason. We didn't have such provision in our legislation, and we never needed it since our independence. Now this is being sent to parliament, and parliament will be discussing it in its upcoming sessions with the aim to signal that the government of Armenia is ready to withdraw a signature if it feels that the process is protracted and that the process is used for the sake of the process rather than the aim, the goal that is at the end of the tunnel. I'll stop it here, and I will be very ready to answer this any questions that might come up. But to end the last idea, when I say that I don't think it's a good time for pressure, I think that at the same time international community shall start thinking about its own exit strategy, as the government of Armenia is thinking about its exit strategy, to minimize the risks of disruption of this process, because it is going to be extremely painful. I'm confident that this rupture will push the region back, not where we started this process, but much beyond that line, with a new level of frustration, with a new level of mistrust, with a new level of suspicion towards each other, and I don't know how ready we are to accept that. I think that it's time for all those players whose authority and whose prestige allowed us to move this far to think what shall be the reward for being faithful to this process, and what shall be the price paid by parties for failing this process. It's what the international community can do now, as opposed to attempting to put an unnecessary pressure on the sides, because it's not going to help. I'll stop here, and we'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sarkisyan, for a really terrific, concise and frank presentation of where you see the normalization process at right now. We have a lot of very, very well-informed and interested folks in the audience. I'm going to turn directly to discussion and questions. I do request that anybody called upon, and I'll be keeping a list as I go around the room, identify themselves. So, yeah. Tom DeWall.
Thanks very much. May I put on, actually it's Tom DeWall, I'll put it on the record. Washington has so far introduced me as Tom DeWall, which is fine, but I say Tom DeWall. very glad to be here. Thanks for choosing me. Two quick questions. One, so far the understanding has been that the parliaments would proceed, as it were, in parallel ratifying the protocols. Do you see any possibility that the Armenian parliament would go first and ratify the protocols first without waiting for the Turkish parliament? And secondly, you've been talking about time flags and so on. Do you see a point beyond which, if there is no movement, as it were, the Armenian government will withdraw its signature? Are we talking, by a few months, the end of this year, something like that, the point which the Armenian government would actually give up on this process if there's no movement on the other side? Thank you.
You want me to answer each question? Let's do each question.
Yeah.
It might be easier as well. First of all, with regards to the sequence of ratifications, no, we don't think it's possible for the Armenian parliament to vote on this first, for a very straightforward reason. Because the president of Armenia, as the head of the majority in parliament, has identified that he is guaranteeing politically that his majority in parliament would vote in favor. In other words, he has shown direct commitment and also has associated his own political reputation with this. Whereas the Turkish side has been identifying all the time that they cannot prejudge or they cannot predict the outcome of voting in Turkish parliament, because they say of the traditions of democracy in the Turkish parliament. We are very respectful of that, but that shows that we have to wait and see, and if the Turkish parliament can find the necessary resources to vote in favor, then there is no doubt that the Armenian parliament will proceed positively on this. As far as the second question is concerned, I think I've said more than I could to be frank with you and at the same time to be non-disclosive of the deadlines, which we don't want to place publicly, and considering this is on record, I don't want to mention the date, but I think I've said everything except naming the date, and it's easy to calculate now with all the factors that I have mentioned.
Bulent.
Yeah, Bulent Ilirza. I run the Turkish program here. You talked about the... it was a very frank presentation, and I thank you for it. You talked about how you're now expecting the Turkish parliament to move. I was in Ankara last week. I went to the Turkish Grand National Assembly, and frankly, the mood is not one that suggests that this is going to be presented at any time in the near future. The chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Murat Merjan, has made that clear. I saw Dr. Merjan, and I do not believe that he's going to make the move. So having been pessimistic about this process, I have to tell you that my pessimism was reinforced by what I saw. Now, you talked about the point of no return, and you were very frank here, and you essentially said the deadline was April 24th. Now, we've known all along that the two issues are very much connected. What worried me from the outset of this process was the extent to which that deadline loomed over the process, even though certain steps, the ones that you identified, were being made. President Obama, you said, was very much instrumental in kicking off the process. Now, President Obama did something that his two predecessors did not do, which is that in not using the word genocide for the events of 1915, he did not cite national security considerations, but he cited the normalization process. He actually said, let's look forward, not back. Now, if the normalization process moves to its intended conclusion, then all is well. But as you said, April 24th is looming, and if that desired outcome is not achieved by then what we're going to get is a rapid reversal of the forward progress. And as you said, you talked about the renewed tensions coming back even more strongly than before. So my question to you is there a fallback position avoid the situation deteriorating very rapidly into one in which, frankly, I think that the Turkish side will blame the Armenian side for using the April 24th deadline to try and get Turkey to move in a direction it does not want to move. Whether you see it as rationalization or you do actually understand the factors that compel him to be like this, Prime Minister Erdogan has said openly that he will not move unless there's movement on the Karabakh front. So he's connected the two issues, even though I read your president's speech at Chatham House. I understand your arguments, but frankly, those are not accepted on the Turkish side. So again, just to wrap up, if we don't get to the desired outcome, what happens then is my question to you.
Thank you. To tell you the truth, I think that protocols are setting such a minimal progress over the situation existing right now. It's the minimum necessary for two countries to start to talk to each other. What do they include? They include diplomatic relations and open border. Anything short of that exists today. There are flights between Yerevan and Istanbul. There is a trade over through third countries. There are some exchanges between people, and there are some migrant workers, the number of which is regularly assessed and reassessed by the Turkish side. And Prime Minister Erdogan has named different figures, starting with 40,000 in the beginning and ending with some 150,000, if I'm not mistaken, in his most recent interview. Our figures are much below that, but it doesn't matter. I mean, there are some contacts between countries. What do these protocols do? They say, let's open the border, and they say, let's establish diplomatic ties so that we don't need to talk through third countries to each other. They don't do anything else. And therefore, I don't see a step that can be short of protocols, but more what we have today to be effective. It will be it could be a face saver, but I don't think it would effectively change anything on the ground. Now, with regards to who could put blame on who for protracting, the problem is that there are too many actors involved in this. Or rather, not a problem, but the advantage of the situation is that there are too many actors involved in this, and everyone knows what the position of the sides is. It's difficult to put a blame on each other in this process because it's just too straightforward. Russians, Americans, Europeans, they all know what the stakes are for the parties, what has been compromised by each of the party, what were the positive and negative steps done by each of the parties in this process. And whoever tries to misuse this, I don't think it will be very effective because it's just too straightforward. I understand that there are political limitations and there are political interests vested in this, but we think that positions of the sides are quite clear on this now.
I wasn't thinking so much about the blame if we get to April 24th without the opening of the border or diplomatic relations, but I just wanted you to think a little bit about what the future would look like if we don't actually get the implementation of the protocols.
Future for who? Well, but I mentioned in my presentations that I think that we shall start to look for exit strategies for the international community. I don't think it's normal when a G20 member state, and G20 is called to fight poverty internationally, is effectively applying a unilateral embargo on a developing economy with high levels of poverty. I think that international community and members of the G20 club shall have a say on that. I think that not opening the border and not using this opportunity, as it has progressed till now, shall be a very good and reasonable motivation for other members of G20 to start raising this with Turkey. I think that it also has to do with WTO obligations and a number of other things which are internationally accepted today. That shall be the exit strategy in my way. If you are asking me if it shall be affecting the genocide recognition by others externally, you know, our position is very well known on this. We are true believers in the Genocide Convention. We are pioneers of many acts that have been adopted after the 1949 Convention. We have a strong feeling that as a nation which has survived the genocide, we have an obligation in front of international community and humankind to bring our own contribution to fighting the possibility of repetition of that crime anytime in the future, anywhere in the world. That's how we perceive it. We perceive it in a much wider context than just Armenian genocide. We think that the recognition of genocide internationally is needed for that very reason. We know that all the big countries whose recognition can be important has sufficient evidence in their own national archives, and we don't need to prove anything to those countries to make them understand what has happened in 1915 and around that year, and we don't need to prove things which are known. There have been statements made then, there have been statements made after that by many, and it's a domestic decision for each country whether to move on this or not. We do bring our own share in all the international organizations to raise this issue, to ring a bell of the threat of genocide. We do strongly believe that if genocides are condemned and recognized properly, it decreases the motivation for the others to ever return to this crime. And not only those who commit it, but anywhere or anyone in the world. We think it's a very important international task. Therefore, we don't want to connect this with a particular progress or fallout of this process. We think that it has to progress on its own, separately, with its own logic, and in each country on its own merits and its own timetables.
Yeah.
Thank you. Berkan Pazarcı, counselor at the Turkish Embassy. First of all, I think it's regrettable that we are where we stand now because of after all these efforts and energy that has been put both by Armenia and Turkey, and also the United States and Switzerland, I think we could have been in a much more constructive and a different environment right now. Unfortunately, but you haven't mentioned that in your speech, the Armenian Constitutional Court, in its detailed decision, doesn't recognize the common border with Turkey, makes reference to the commitment to pursue its international policy, its policy for the international recognition of the so-called genocide, which makes obsolete the protocols, suggesting that there will be a joint historians commission that will deal with this period of our joint history. So the Turkish government, as you know, didn't declare these protocols as dead. We are still committed to the protocols. We think it's going to be for bilateral relationship, but also for the whole region, for the peace of the whole region and the welfare. But I wonder if now, I mean, the onus should not be only on Turkey. I wonder if the Armenian Republic is going to display a strong willingness and clarify this contaminated environment due to the Constitutional Court's detailed decision. And because the Turkish parliament will need such a clarification in order to move ahead, we cannot just act as if nothing happened, given the fact that the Constitutional Court actually, I think, outstepped its bounds and entered into the political realm by giving directives to the executive branch and by also stating that any executive step that would be taken according to these protocols should be subject to the review of the Constitutional Court, which means that at any time, at any stage, the Constitutional Court of Armenia can put itself in the place of the executive branch and backpedal, hamper the process. Likewise, I mean, if the Armenian parliament ratifies these protocols by making reference to the Constitutional Court's detailed decision, it may tantamount to a kind of reservation on the protocols. So this difficulty that has been, this complication that has been created by the court's decision is going to be very difficult to, in the sense that we will have to, or maybe the Armenian government will have to convince the Turkish parliament that legally there shouldn't be any problem to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, first of all, because yesterday I was talking at the Fletcher Club of New York, and it was initially scheduled as a panel discussion with Ambassador Abakan, who has been instrumental in moving this forward. I very much regretted to know that there was a last-minute dropout and a change of format where Ambassador Abakan preferred to speak separately 1 week later on the same set of issues. I thought it might be a very constructive ground for discussion of the issues and coming to a common understanding of possible limitations. But with regards to your question, I want to make it very clear. We understand the concern. We have heard it publicly. As you know, no one internationally shares that concern, because both Russians and Americans have identified that they don't see any problem in the Constitutional Court's decision. I want to clarify a little bit. First of all, there was accusation heard publicly, sounded publicly, that why Constitutional Court would need to pronounce at all. I want to make it very clear that any treaty ratified by the Armenian Parliament is first going through the Constitutional Court. It's a requirement of our Constitution, and that's how we ratify any treaties that we sign and move to Parliament. Second, I want to make a reference for those of you who are lawyers particularly, that one thing to be kept in mind is that Constitutional Court proceeded 1.5 months in advance of its legal deadline to show the commitment to timely part of the test, legal timetable. Second, they adopted the decision unilaterally without any dissenting opinion, which is a regular practice for the Constitutional Court of Armenia to have separate opinion of certain judges on issues. And third, what it said at the end of the day was the decision of the Constitutional Court is the only decision that would allow for ratification in Parliament. They said there is nothing in these protocols that can be interrupted as violating the Constitution of the Republic of Armenia. There could be a second pronouncement instead of that, which would say that there are elements which contradict the requirements of the Constitution, and then it would require the executive branch to go back and renegotiate those things. There is no third way in this process. It's either in line with the Constitution or not complying with the requirements of the Constitution. Now, I think that no one could expect that protocols or any international treaty signed by any country in the world can amend its own constitution. No one should have expected that the protocols as they are signed can change the substance of the constitution of the Republic of Armenia. As a matter of fact, the Constitutional Court did not refer to the boundaries and borders of Turkey in its decision. It just said that with reference to all the possible articles of the Constitution that can be involved in this situation, there is no contradiction between the protocols and the articles. I thought that this is a good development. Actually, not only I and not only Armenia, But you know that the United States government has welcomed that decision of the Constitutional Court. The Swiss has been very positive about it. And all the others involved, they think that this is a good thing that has happened. There is nothing in the decision that would offer that Constitutional Court can ever take the role of executive branch. Actually, it would contradict the Constitution of the Republic of Armenia because we have a very clear-cut separation of powers, and Constitutional Court, by its decision, cannot change its constitutional function. It's not anything that is close to a reasonable development that could follow. I think the concerns are basically groundless. As far as the emotions are concerned, of course, there has been many elements and many moments in this process that draws emotions on both sides. There have been many statements by high-level, high-ranking Turkish officials that could have aborted this process many times ever since it started, and particularly the statements of Prime Minister who have many times referred to a position where he said this will never be ratified. But as we understand, this is a complex situation where there are domestic and international issues involved, and we thought that it is possible to proceed with all the difficulties the statements raise in Armenia and in Armenian diaspora to the stage where we are now. We still hope that this is going to proceed. We are not as pessimistic as you said it sounded. We think that there is still a good ground to move forward and ratify. We don't think we are in a pity situation. We think we are in a very lucky situation where the choice is ours, yours and ours. And we think that this now has to be grounded on our own political vision. If we want to do it, we can do it. If we don't, then we can find thousands of excuses for not doing it on different levels and on both sides.
Do you think after this, the decision, according to the detailed decision of the Armenian Constitutional Court, it is still possible for the Armenian government to engage in a dialogue on the historical dimension without a preordained outcome?
Absolutely. I think this is a very, very important element of these protocols. I want to mention, by the way, you spoke about the Commission of Historians. The protocols do not provide for a Commission of Historians. The protocols provide for a sub-commission of the intergovernmental commission that will be dealing with the dimension of history. These are two very different concepts. I want to invite your attention to that. And this subcommission is among many other subcommissions that are provided for by these protocols, including one on transportation issues and one on educational issues and one on and so on and so forth, economic issues. You know, our two peoples have had a very long joint history. And it has been a history of living within one empire and on the borders of each other as well. And it has been history where there have been many positive things along with many negative things. When we were hosted in Bursa, all those present were recalling the very positive and significant impacts that Armenians have had in Ottoman Empire. And we have serious records of the positive pages of our common history. We think that the mosaic of our history is so complex that the work of that subcommission is going to be extremely challenging and extremely interesting. I am jealous about the work that subcommission will have to do. I am not envy about the patience of the people involved because I understand that it's going to be a torturous exercise at times. Will that subcommission refer to the issues of genocide? I think at some point, in certain context, it will, because it's a very important part of our joint history. Will it be discussing issues of whether the genocide has happened or not? My belief is that no, because it's difficult to discuss it when there is a provision in the Turkish Criminal Code prohibiting the very usage of the word genocide. And it's going to be extremely difficult for any historian in that commission, as well as any expert involved, to discuss this openly. I think it's going to be a long work for that subcommission, as well as for many other subcommissions involved in this process. But I'm sure this will be a very positive work for both sides, allowing us to find more common grounds, to build up the feelings between our two peoples, which have been damaged seriously throughout these years. And I think this will allow for a better understanding of each other.
Thank you. I have several questions. My name is John Evans. I used to be U.S. ambassador in Yerevan. And that in that connection, I'd just like to point out to everyone here what a great asset it has been for the international community in Armenia to have young and well-educated professionals like Vigen and, I must say, like Vartan Oskanian, who was foreign minister for 10 years. It has given us great confidence in our dialogue. And I say that not just as an American diplomat, but I know it's true for others as well. Vigen, there's several questions I have, and I'll let you choose which ones you want to answer. You didn't say anything about the conflict that took place between Russia and Georgia in August of 2008. Some of us had the idea that that event may have sobered many people in the Caucasus, and I wondered if you had a perspective on that. I'm also interested in what I think it's no secret, or not a big secret at least, that Armenia and Turkey already before the election of President Sargsyan had been engaged in quiet talks in Vienna and various other locales. Your colleague Armen Kirikosyan, who used to be Armenian ambassador here in Washington, I believe, was very much involved in that. And I'm wondering to what extent the new developments have built on that earlier dialogue. Also, as a former professional diplomat, I've been struck that in the hierarchy of agreements between states, protocols really are at the bottom. A protocol is a record of a discussion. It can be the record of a conference, the record of a bilateral discussion, and it's very rare to have protocols ratified. And that leads me to a further point that in looking at the protocols, it seems to me that both sides seem to have inserted in these documents, which do require ratification right there in the text, so many difficult elements in one way or the other that it's like tying a Gordian knot in order to then untie it. And it seems to me that I don't know precisely in the case of either Armenia or Turkey, but in general diplomatic practice, simply to start diplomatic relations or to open a border does not require usually so much, it does not require the parliament normally. And I wonder if if you're thinking about strategies, I'll be quick, Andrew, this is the end. If you're thinking about what to do if this process fails, why couldn't the two executives simply say, okay, now we're going to have diplomatic relations?
I just want to confirm with the ambassador that we do have till about 1:30. Mm-hmm. Okay, great, because we have several other questions out there. Okay. Please.
Sure, thank you very much. Ambassador, I recall with great warmth period when you have been in Yerevan and all the wonderful discussions we have had about these and many other issues involved, and for everything you have been doing so consistently for promoting Armenian-American friendship, which has very deep historic roots and to which you referred very many times in your diplomatic career. I want to refer to all of your questions because they are all absolutely important and deeply informed questions, of course. First, about our Georgia-Russia conflict and wars there. Of course, we have been the ones who have felt it immediately and very closely and on a daily basis. As you know, two out of four borders that Armenia has are effectively blockaded, one by Turkey and one by Azerbaijan. Two others are with Iran and with Georgia, and with instability in Georgia, Armenia was again left once again. We have had once such situation in early 90s, and now we were returning to that, when the only route of transportation of food and goods to Armenia and energy resources would be from Iran, which once again emphasized the importance of the strategy of developing infrastructure in that direction and on that border. But I think that what was important in that conflict were lessons that had to be drawn by everyone. And we thought that the response by the Turkish president to travel to Armenia upon the invitation, and I've mentioned it in the beginning of my presentation, as it came after the war in Georgia, probably was partly motivated also by that understanding of the necessity of opening up alternatives in the region. For Armenia, it was a difficult time, and I think that what we really managed to do quite effectively was combination of our strategic partnership obligations towards Russia with our neighborly friendship obligations toward Georgia. It was a very delicate line, and it was a very difficult line, but I think that everyone involved knows that Armenia has found the best way to accommodate these two probably confronting interests. And it was due to a number of reasons. First of all, because of a delicate approach of all those Western powers who needed support of Armenia in terms of providing humanitarian assistance and so on to Georgia. And at the same time, because of very delicate approach of the Russian government that has never put Armenia at a choice of being with it or against it in that war. It was a very important signal of the sincerity of the friendship between our two countries for us. Second, Armenian-Turkish protocols, why they need to be ratified. You mentioned correctly, it was decision of the parties to include that clause in the protocols, which makes the ratification necessary for both. For Armenia, it's also part of our constitutional requirement, because our constitution straightforwardly states that any international agreements that have high political importance have to be ratified. I think that no one would doubt that these protocols have a lot of political sensitivity and a lot of political importance for Armenia. So for us, it was no alternative choice. I think that reciprocally, therefore, for Turkey, it was also a necessity to ratify. But even besides that, there was a mutual understanding that we want to proceed through democratic authorization of this choice of executive branches. And we thought that this is a smart thing to do. Why are they so detailed? Because I think that there has been so much mistrust and so much difficulty between two countries that everyone wanted to create as much safeguards as possible. But you are absolutely right, as in any negotiations, more safeguards you place, more difficult it is to move. It decreases the level of flexibility. Legalistically, protocols are what they meant to be, what they say they are, what they contain in themselves as a text. We don't see obligations beyond the protocols. We feel a need to talk to each other in a polite manner, which we try to do as much as possible. I think you have felt all the positive gestures and all the softballs which were sent by Armenian side most recently by sending a telegram to President Gül overflying the airspace of Turkey on the way to London, which was full of positivistic signals, the signing of the speech at the Chatham House, and the decision to send protocols to the parliament. We have been very appreciative of very positive response we received from President Gül. Some very positive comments we have received later from Minister Davutoglu. We want to hope that this is part of a wider strategy of moving in the positive direction. We think that there is no winner and loser in this situation, which is the only possible scenario for development of this. We think it's mutually beneficial. We think it creates a new phase for the whole region and definitely for our two countries. We understand all the concerns and all the limitations, but we know that there is a way to move forward. It's again about the political will and decision. And finally, your third question with regards to the previous talks and whether this was a build-up on that or not. There have been talks, indeed, ever since the two countries had no relations. But I think that the invitation itself was revolutionary in terms of setting a new ground, because talks before that were much more at technical level. They did not provide for political leadership and vision, which is essential to move this thing forward. I mean, I don't think that any diplomat at any level of sophistication would be able to negotiate and open the border without two heads of states and top leadership of the countries willing to do so and moving in that direction. That's why I think it was a key difference between everything that has been happening before that and what has happened after the election of President Sarkisian.
Fiona.
Thanks. Fiona Hill from the Brookings Institution. In the spirit of Ambassador Evans' questions about what to do if the process fails, what's Plan B, I thought I might throw a few things out there because I think all of us sitting around the table can see how everyone can lose from this. I don't think if this process falls apart, there's going to be any winner here, even those who might think they might be able to manipulate the situation to their advantage. And I think Ambassador Evans had a really good point here about the issue of ratification. And, you know, maybe it might actually merit some rethinking, even given what you've said about the importance that this of this domestically and, in fact, the constitutional provision. I'm thinking, though, for some of the international examples here that might be a bit helpful. Russia and Japan, for example, don't even have a peace treaty signed since World War II. They still have a territorial dispute that probably looks fairly insignificant now with the Kuril Islands, but in fact that's been a major obstacle at different junctures. But they've got diplomatic relations going. They'll probably never have a peace treaty. I would lay bets on that, certainly not in our lifetimes. And it's been 50 years since World War II. And obviously there's a lot of issues between them, but they've found a way of moving forward. There are also a couple of other examples in Europe involving Poland. Germany and Poland still have a pretty difficult relationship, but recently they've actually made an effort to band together to actually work in the neighbourhood that used to be so complicated for both of them. Perhaps you might even consider asking the Germans and Poles to give some ideas in pushing this process forward. There's also the Russian-Polish Committee on Difficult Questions, which is a kind of a slightly oddly titled effort, but it's very much like the subcommission that you're thinking about. And Poland and Germany have some pretty darn difficult questions between them. They have a very distinguished person, Adam Rotfeld, who many people around the table know from Ambassador Rotfeld, who is chairing this. And certainly there's a lot of animosity, there's a lot of traded barbs, insults on both sides. President Putin has been very rude about members of the commission at different points, and they've still managed to move forward and have actually made some achievements. And they've gone back and forth on Katyn, for example, one day denying it on the Russian part, next day kind of moving forward and going, okay, well, maybe something happened there. So, I mean, there are some examples out there that you may be able to look at. And I would just really urge at this point some serious thinking along the lines that Ambassador Evans outlined, that this is going to be a disaster unless somebody is bold enough to perhaps move away from principle.
No, thank you very much. Of course, it's a very legitimate point and it's a possible ground for consideration. Politically, I think it's impossible after you have announced something as a subject to ratification to do the same thing without ratification. I think it's something that would be undoable for any of the parties, and reasonably so. I think, though, that you are absolutely right that there can be substitutes for that. There can be opening of border without protocols. You don't need to sign a protocol and ratify it to be able to withdraw occupation, basically the blockade or embargo. I do agree there can be a certain step taken to show positive will on the side of the parties involved. But, I think that the way it is negotiated and the way it is done now, it is much more than any of the parties could have expected to achieve within this 1 year. And to lose this now, even if any semi-measures are taken, they will be only very vulnerable and very unsustainable, because it will create a motivation to keep on closing the border and opening the border in and out, and doing it voluntarily without any commitment to international law and so on. We therefore think that the way to proceed here is to ratify and implement in full faith. If no, then, of course, I mean, it doesn't preclude a possibility of other discussions and other possible steps. But again, I think that the level of mistrust will increase so dramatically that it will push the region much beyond where we started 1 year ago. I don't see an easy alternative strategy now that can be effective. It can be a face-saver strategy, probably. It can be a strategy that is allowing to minimize the international risks for any of the party, which protracts or withdraws or aborts this process. But I don't think it will be anywhere close to the benefits of ratifying these documents as they are negotiated. In general, I want to tell you that whatever exit strategies are thought by the international community and Armenia, none of them will bring the region anywhere close to where it can be with this protocol's proceeding. Because this would be an example of jointly doing a step, jointly creating a ground for a progressive development of regional cooperation. And it can be very important for everyone involved, including Georgia and Azerbaijan and other players in the region. I think that that's where we shall concentrate our efforts and our thinking.
Very fast. To Fiona's list, one might add the situation that President Coolidge faced after the U.S.-Turkish Treaty of Lausanne was put before the Senate, and it was so unpopular at that time that he used executive privilege to establish relations with the Republic of Turkey and to receive the first Turkish ambassador.
You know, I didn't realize that I actually had the power to turn off people's microphone by turning mine on. It's like Gorbachev in 1988 when he turned off Sakharov's microphone. Okay, I've been waiting patiently. Several folks on the left side of the room. Let me turn to the back to our visiting fellow from Yerevan, Hovhannes.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm Hovhannes Nikolosyan, a visiting fellow at Russia Eurasia. And actually, I have two questions about the ratification process and the background, very briefly. Although the two protocols are interconnected and the constitutional court ruling also recognizes the links between them, but has Armenian government ever thought that Turkish side could ratify only the first protocol on diplomatic relations, which does not have any timetable for the border opening? I would like to remind that the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties foresees such action by either of bilateral treaties. And the second very brief question, David Phillips, a very notable figure in Armenian-Turkish front, wrote in a column a couple of days ago that negotiators, namely Armenians and Turks, finalized the protocols in February and initiated their annexes on April the 2nd last year, and just on the eve of the Obama's visit to Turkey. But the joint trilateral statement was published on April 22nd. If you consider this as a failure, who's to blame for it, and what's planned to be done this year to escape repeating the same mistake? What has been lessened out of it? Yeah, thank you.
With your second question, could you give further explanation of what you want to hear from me?
Yeah, David Phillips wrote that protocols have been initiated and well before the April 22nd. But as far as they popped up just on the eve of the April 24th, it is generally believed that it prohibited or for President Obama not to use the G word in his statement.
Okay. Thank you. With regards to first question, the answer is extremely technical because the protocols themselves contain a clause that they can be only ratified and implemented jointly in a linkage. In other words, the protocols contain in themselves a clause that says that one cannot proceed with the other. They are linked with each other. And Constitutional Court didn't do anything else except for emphasizing that provision. In other words, it's something that the parties, including Turkey, have voluntarily agreed to and signed in a form of a legally binding text. So there is no doubt about that. No, one protocol without the other cannot be effective, and it cannot be implemented neither legally nor substantially. They are too much interlinked, both in terms of their provisions and in terms of the essence and the spirit of the protocols. Even if there was no such clause in the protocols, as you know, the Vienna Convention says on law of treaties provides that a treaty has to be complied in a good faith and that they have to be applied in line with the spirit and with the substance of the documents. It's obvious that these two are so much interlinked that one without the other would seriously damage the spirit and the substance. With regards to David Phillips, I have read his column in Boston Globe. I've had two chances to meet with him most recently in Yerevan. He was presenting his book, the Armenian translation, about their efforts in TARC, as well as later on yesterday he was present at the Fletcher Club and made some very interesting comments about the Armenia-Turkey process. You know, with regards to recognition again and using of G-word or not using the G-word, we very much feel that it's a political decision to be made by each of the parties which gets into that, especially by all those parties who have been involved in World War One in different ways and have primary source information on what was happening there. Any statement or any policy around that can be an excuse or a cause for using or not using the word. It can never be the reason for that. The reasons are always much deeper. We don't want to connect these two things to each other. It will be up to each government involved again to think whether it's time, it's appropriate to move on that or not. And I think you understand that Armenia has very little leverage over administration of big countries like United States to make them recognize the genocide. It's not something that we think is feasible for us. We watch the developments closely. They are important for us always, but we are not an party which is influencing those processes in any form.
Yes, you've been waiting very patiently right here.
Thank you very much. I'm Emil Sanavan from the Armenian Reporter. I actually was going to ask a question similar to what Ovan has asked, but I will ask it in a little different format now. Last year, there were reports that President Biden spoke with President Sargsyan shortly before April 24th and sort of got the blessing for the position that President Obama took on April 24th. Do you support the current process to pass the resolution in Congress? I mean, obviously, it's an American political process, but do you welcome this process? As well as what would it take for this process to coexist with what you're trying to achieve on the Turkish track?
I think I have answered it in my previous answer. To be absolutely honest with you and to be very frank with you, when I look back to speech by President Obama, not the statement he delivered on April 24, but the speech he did in Turkish Parliament, which is to me much more important, actually, I have a big difficulty understanding the difference between what he said and what he didn't say. I think that it's an internal process for each country, and I don't think Republic of Armenia has leverages over processes in U.S. Congress as well as in major parliaments of other key countries of the world. For decisions made there are always serious political reasons, and everything else is an excuse to move or not. I don't want to link these two things to each other.
Yes.
I'm Kazar Ibrahim from Embassy of Azerbaijan. Mr. Sargsyan, I want to take on a couple of, from my perspective, important words you have mentioned. One of them is living together. Another one is regional cooperation. Another one is economic advantages Turkey-Armenia process can bring to. And in the end, I want to come back to the negotiations on both sides. First of all, you mentioned about the living together with Turkey. In fact, Armenia and Azerbaijan were living together within the one state, so there is long history of coexistence. In terms of economic links, yeah, that's true, that everybody would benefit if there are economic opportunities and if all the roadblocks are removed. But the point is that in order to have it, you have to look into the root causes and you have to see what these roadblocks are. You mentioned about the blockade by Turkey and Azerbaijan. Well, in terms of Azerbaijan, we physically can't blockade Armenia because our borders are occupied and all the territories within Azerbaijan are under occupation. So there is no way how we can remove that. And also in terms of Turkey closing the border on the other side, You mentioned that it was because it was Armenian Nagorno-Karabakh Defense Forces which stopped aggression. But in fact, it was occupation of one of the Azerbaijan districts where never a single Armenian lived. So this is a reality, and therefore you have to speak from reality in order to move forward. But of course it's true that if we bring the economic dimension, it would benefit all. And even if you open the Turkey-Armenia border without opening Azerbaijan-Armenia border, there is basically very, very little and very slight economic advantage for either Armenia or Turkey, because Central Asia will be closed, and then there is no way actually to go further. And that brings me to the issue of negotiations, which you mentioned, that all international community, and specifically you mentioned United States, Switzerland, and Russia, which helped to move Turkey-Armenia process forward. But at the same time, almost the same group of countries, with one change, Switzerland replaced by France, have worked for almost 15 years to bring Armenia-Azerbaijan-Nagorno-Karabakh progress forward. And there is no achievement so far. And we're in a very sensitive situation today. So my question is, concluding, is given your basically call to international community to help move forward Turkey-Armenia process, why don't you call to international community to move this 15-year-old process and put this process together when we can move on both sides? Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a good question. It's a set of questions, actually, and I'll try to answer them as comprehensively as possible. You know, it's an issue of tactics and methodology rather than the substance that I was referring to. I'm not saying that open borders solve problems. I say that it's easier to solve problems with open borders rather than to try to solve them under a situation where you have mistrust, cut communications, no dialogue between civil societies, no dialogue at the people-to-people level. That's what I was referring to. As far as the Armenian-Turkey border is concerned, we strongly believe it would also benefit Azerbaijan significantly for a number of reasons, including new possibilities for Nakhichevan, for new possibilities for transportation infrastructures existed there. Of course, if this was a panel or a discussion on Nagorno-Karabakh, I would go in much detail of the border, showing to you that all those important parts of the border which can be deblocked are immediate borders between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They have nothing to do with the territories around Nagorno-Karabakh. I remember driving through the beautiful places of Kazakh, which is on the border of Armenia near Ijevan, when I was on my way to my grandmother's house in Georgia. I remember that South Caucasus very well. And believe me, there are many opportunities out there, even if with the map existing as is today. Now, as far as the occupation and causes are concerned, of course, we are very much in favor of solving the reasons and the substance of the conflict instead of eliminating or attempting to eliminate the outcomes of it. And you are absolutely right. If you try to eliminate the outcomes before eliminating the motives of the conflict, you are not getting a sustainable peace. Now, what we reasonably disagree on, probably, is what are the causes of this conflict. You are now saying that the difficulty is the occupation of territories around Nagorno-Karabakh by Armenian forces of self-defense. I would strongly disagree with that, as do many of those experts who deal with this conflict on the long run, and they do know that this occupation was a response of the forces of self-defense to the ethnic cleansings and the major attack by Azeri armed forces on the Armenian minority living in Azerbaijan, not only in Nagorno-Karabakh, but throughout the territory of Azerbaijan, including Baku and Sumgayit and Kirovabad. And to recall that, it's just necessary to go back to the resolutions of the European Parliament and many other major organizations, which have been very vocal on that. The reality was different. Soviet Union had not collapsed that at that time, and the attention of the international human rights watchdogs was very much on the issues of minorities within Soviet Union. And they are very straightforward on what was happening there in those days. It's true that as a result of the campaign there, Armenian forces of self-defense were able to secure a zone of security for Nagorno-Karabakh people. You call it occupied territories, we call it the security belt. We both have reasons for that. When I graduated from Fletcher in a few years from then, I met my friend from Kennedy School, with whom we studied simultaneously at the same time, Moti Kristal from Jerusalem, who handed me his visit card. He worked in the Ministry of Defense of Israel at the time, and the visit card said, head of the Division of Occupied Territories. I was very surprised because we had a big internal discussion whether we shall refer to territories around Nagorno-Karabakh as occupied or not. When once Minister of Foreign Affairs of Armenia, to who you referred, Ambassador Vartan Oskanyan, had an occasion in the airport on foot to refer to them as occupied territories, there was a big internal discussion whether he was right to do or wrong. That's because of the negative sense of the word occupation that we all have in our minds. It depends on how you perceive the situation on the ground. What is important is that the president of Armenia, who was minister of defense before that, has many times stated that he doesn't watch those territories as historic Armenian lands. He has always stated that these territories have to return to Azerbaijan when the settlement for Nagorno-Karabakh is found. But returning those territories is not a settlement. It's just elimination of the outcomes of the conflict without solving or addressing its causes. I know that what I am saying now can provoke numerous questions and a big discussion on Nagorno-Karabakh. I am ready to fly back to Washington one day to speak about Karabakh, if that's of interest. But basically, that's how we perceive it from Yerevan. And I know that you would probably reasonably disagree with this. But, predictably. But basically, I think that solving Armenian-Turkey impasse or building up this rapprochement can be a very good example of how conflicts and disagreements can be addressed in the 21st century. We think that's the way to move forward. We think it creates more stability, more predictability for everyone. It creates a lot of positive ground for cooperation. And we strongly believe that despite the difference in the natural resources and so on, the comparative advantage of the countries in the region would allow for a quick development of the whole region of South Caucasus with the open borders and regional cooperation in place. We have no doubts about that. We think that Azerbaijan would benefit from it, Georgia would benefit from it, Armenia would benefit from it, and regional players would benefit from it. And then we can sit down and work for centuries or decades on the disagreements we might have. I hope that this can be solved easily if we talk to each other, if we work with each other, if our business communities meet each other, do business together as they do in Moscow and elsewhere, where they have common interests, and that's natural.
And on that optimistic note, I'm afraid we're going to have to bring our discussion to an end. You know, when I heard today that that the lunch was not going to arrive in time for the seminar, I thought, well, maybe that's a good thing, because a discussion of Turkish-Armenian relations could result in a food fight. But that was really not the case. It was a very, very thoughtful discussion, and I'm very grateful to you, Mr. Sargsyan, for your presentation and your thoughtful remarks to the questions, and also to to all of you here for your comments and questions. I personally learned a lot. I personally am very supportive of normalization going forward, and I know that you personally put a lot of effort into this, and we hope that this will be successful, and we will take you up on your offer to come back to Washington and talk about Nagorno-Karabakh. Thank you very much.
Thank you.